So, to begin with, just to get us started, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background and perhaps a little bit about your childhood and where you grew up to begin with. Over to you.
Yes, I was born just before the Second World War. Therefore, my early childhood was very much affected by the conditions that we were living under at the time. My father was around, but not always present. He was a conscientious objector and worked in hospital work. So we saw him fairly often, well, most of the time, really. And he was a very anxious person, but a very caring parent. My mother carried a huge burden, really, because she and my maternal grandfather spent most of their time working very hard at maintaining the family home and running a business. We were brought up as Congregationalists in an independent church, which is one of two in my hometown. My father didn't find it a congenial place all the time because of his stance on pacifism. Some people were very hostile to him. But I had a very happy childhood, and we were very much involved in church life. And I appreciated the cultural aspects of this. I was brought up in a musical atmosphere, you might say. My aunt was a music teacher, piano teacher, and taught me. And so we grew up listening to a lot of music. And my church favoured a rather traditional form of music, and the choir would sing except from oratorios and that sort of thing, in the evening service particularly. We heard a lot from lay preachers in church, some of them women, but there was a minister present most of the time. One of my earliest memories was of the minister of our church, John Banks, who died after an accident getting out of a train in the dark. And I remember my father telling me about that. So I think we had a very, you might say, a very religious background, but it wasn't a seriously fundamentalist background, although we did rely a lot on the Bible, as Protestants tend to, for our sources of authority. But much of what I remember of particularly the New Testament stemmed from Sunday school and church. As far as I can recall, sexuality never entered into this dialogue. Although I was aware that there were two women in the congregation who were close friends, and we would now call them partners. But women's sexuality really wasn't ever talked about in those days, nor was men's for that matter. As far as I knew, there was no male gay person in the congregation, but there was in the other church, which was our sort of rival congregation. And I think quite early on I recognised that he was a single male, whereas most people were married. And therefore I grew up with an awareness that not everybody conformed to the norm, as it were. But since the issue of homosexuality was never mentioned, there was nothing threatening about anything that I discovered as time went on about my own sexuality. I suppose it was only really when I started to feel anxious about the possibility that if I fancied somebody, they might not reciprocate and they might feel uncomfortable about it. But I did know a number of boys in school who I'm sure were gay. One of them was quite well known. He's well known in the media these days, Ian McKellen, so there's no harm in mentioning his name. And I was at primary school with him, and in fact I knew the family slightly. But there was no mention of sexuality in those days, so it wasn't an issue. I think my father recognised that I had a crush on a friend when I got to secondary school, grammar school. And he never seemed to feel uncomfortable about it. He may have been anxious, but he was an anxious person about most things anyway, so the issue was never raised. He did advise me at one point not to worry too much if I couldn't fix my friend Joe's bike. But that's the only thing I can recall. But of course you were aware that since sexuality was never mentioned, it was not just a taboo subject, it was a taboo activity if you went in for that sort of thing. Because otherwise it would have been talked about, and wasn't.
And how did that make you feel when you were aware that perhaps you were different?
I think I just picked up that whatever your feelings were, you didn't talk about them. You kept them to yourself. I think when I got to grammar school, there were occasional uncomfortable moments. But I think on the whole, you know, you just kept your mouth shut and might have shown interest in people from time to time. But my best friends were I felt very comfortable with, and didn't show any unusual affection towards them, I think. One friend that I had at the time is still a friend, and he was straight, we'd say. And when he went into the Royal Air Force, we used to correspond weekly. And the letter always ended up with "Love, Joe, John." And I think there was a genuine affection, but it wasn't sexual in the genital sense at all. The one or two people I recognise as what we might have called poofs in those days didn't attract me at all. I found them very unappealing. So there was never any question of uncomfortable encounters with them, because I just had no interest in them. I suppose the first time the issue might have been raised in church, in a church context, was when I went to a conference, a ministry conference for people who might have been considering ministry in the church. And one of the interviewers who held a position in the church, in the Congregational Union, I think in the Manchester area, startled me slightly when we were talking about ministry, and he told me he thought I would make a wonderful minister, at which point he put his hand on my right knee and grasped it rather firmly, and I thought that was slightly unusual, but I didn't find it offensive. And I suppose that was the first time I might have been aware that the church might have had difficulty with the issue.
Okay. Had you considered then going into some form of ministry within the church?
Well, I was on the point of thinking about it. I wouldn't say I'd made any decision, but I was always a rather pious little child, and I enjoyed church. I thought church was great. There were some very boring sermons, I can recall, but at the same time, I thought it all seemed rather worthwhile. I thought goodness was really a good thing.
Sure.
And to that extent, I think any form of love between human beings, I would have considered a positive thing.
So what was it then that you decided not to go into ordained ministry, for want of a better expression?
I didn't have a strong feeling of vocation. I had an interest in the subject, but not in the role of minister. I don't think I ever saw myself in that role, in that light at all.
Were you aware, and you mentioned it briefly, were you aware of a growing tension between sort of the gay community and the church?
Not particularly, because, as I say, the issue was never raised in church circles in those days. It was just, it was not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was a sort of subtext when any mention of sexuality came into conversation or into the public discussion. I mean, when people talked about marriage, for instance, it was quite clear what they were talking about was between a man and a woman. And the rules were fairly strict. Divorce was frowned upon. And therefore, the possibility of having same-sex relationship on any sort of permanent basis was never a real issue.
How did that make you feel?
It made me feel that I didn't quite know how I would live my life in future. It was something that was very much an unknown quantity. And I don't suppose it was until I actually... Well, the initial stages of any sort of sexual relationship are the sense of falling in love, but that in itself didn't necessarily lead to a permanent relationship, although one hoped that it would continue, and it was important. And therefore, I think I was very careful not to give any cause for anxiety on the part of another person, I said. And I can remember one occasion when I was with my friend, whom I mentioned just now, who wrote to me when he was in the area. We went on holiday, there were four of us, and we went off in a very old Ford van and had a trip round the southeast of England. And we camped out. And I remember on one occasion, and I suppose he was trying to ascertain something about my attitude towards him, he got into my sleeping bag. But I was so terrified of doing anything that might upset him that I didn't reciprocate any feelings that he might have shown towards me. But I think it showed that he was a kindly and tolerant, understanding person. So I think that was affirmative for me. It wasn't a bad experience, even though, as I say, it didn't go any further.
Mm. And as time went on, did you become more aware of, with the advent of channels like Channel 4, where they were focusing on LGBT issues a lot of the time, and with conversations within the church around sexuality, did you become more aware of the conflict between church and society together and human sexuality?
Yes, it did. It did surface from time to time, usually in the form of a scandal of some sort.
Okay.
A public scandal, some figure in public might have been targeted by the media. But it wasn't really until I got to university that I got to grips with the thing. And of course, until I was 29 years old, it was illegal to be gay. Well, to do anything about it.
Sure.
But at university, I came across people who were obviously very sympathetic and understanding. Particularly one woman whom I still know, who seemed to accept it as perfectly normal. She had a boyfriend who had mixed in circles in London where homosexuality was not considered anything out of the ordinary. So she was very tolerant and understandable, well, more than tolerant. I think she was in love with me. She met up with somebody else and she fell in love with him, and I fell in, no, he fell in love with her and I fell in love with him. So it was a very curious triangular situation. But it was very productive and lasted quite a long time. He died some years ago now, but she and I still converse from time to time, although she's very disabled. They had one child who was female and is now male.
Okay. So we're talking about university and your friendships that you had there.
Yes, I met the Anglican chaplain in the university. Although I was still Congregationalist, I was feeling I wanted to spread my wings a bit. And through the student Christian movement, I met more people, including Franciscan Friar, who became a very good friend. And he was one of the first people I'd met who seemed completely open and willing to befriend me. I didn't have any inhibition about that. There was nothing sexual about it, on the surface anyway. But it became quite clear that he under any circumstances would be very supportive, and I told him about my sexuality. So I think that was the first time I'd really got to grips with the whole issue in the context, in a sort of theological context.
And how old were you then?
I would be about 20.
Okay. And did that kind of journey of self-understanding or acceptance and acknowledgement continue after university? Was there kind of progression in that?
Well, I maintained contact with him after I left university. I'd already visited the friary in Alnmouth in Northumberland when they were setting that up, and felt very much at home there. And I realised that for a lot of people, the religious life, as it was understood, was the answer. And probably have been throughout the church's history. Although it was never publicly acknowledged. And of course that's continued till the present day, and it's still causing problems for some parts of the church. But we're getting to grips with it now.
Is that something you had considered then? Were you considering potentially sort of a monastic?
Well, inevitably I thought of the possibility. But I felt fairly certain that I wanted to be free to make relationships apart from any sort of church sponsored institutions, and I did develop friendships with a number of people at that time, and was very grateful of that. Although I wouldn't have said that I pursued them. And the person who first made a beeline for me, who is still a friend actually, didn't appeal to me in that way. So, although he helped me to overcome some inhibitions, it didn't lead to any sort of permanent sexual relationship. Although he was pretty keen and pretty persistent in that sense. But that wasn't a bad thing, that was very good. And he was also sympathetic to my religious point of view. And I in fact met him through Brother Michael the Franciscan, who I mentioned just now. So, you know, one thing leads to another, and I became more open and accepting of the possibility of a longer standing relationship. But I still wasn't sure whether that there was any future in what we might regard now as a partnership or a marriage between people of the same sex. I was always interested in the sort of biblical aspects of this and didn't find anything in the Bible that really put me off at all. I mean, one occasionally came across negative views even in the New Testament, but they didn't seem to me crucial. And as far as I could see, and I've been brought up to pay most attention to the teaching of the Gospels and the recorded words of Jesus, and I found nothing in that to deter me.
Okay, great. Is there anything else sort of in that period, sort of maybe from childhood into university, that I should have asked you about, or that sticks out in your memory?
I was a fairly private person, and I didn't share my inner thoughts much with other people. I mentioned Brother Michael. I mentioned the chaplain at University of Grendel. He died, well, they both did now. But Graham's wife, Sue, was a very close friend of mine. And she was quite a considerable writer and feminist at the time. And I'm still in touch with her many years later. So I always felt that there were people around who supported me. But I never felt that I wanted to be particularly militant about it.
Okay.
I would have probably stood up for my beliefs if any challenged me. But as I say, there was very little public discussion in those days. I mean, in church circles, certainly.
Okay, so then moving perhaps into more recent times, or perhaps when you left university, you're heavily involved in 3F. Do you want to talk a little about that and the journey that you've been on with 3F and how long that's been going on for and your involvement, and just talk around that perhaps a little bit?
Well, 3F came about through LGCM, which I joined at the beginning of the organisation. I was there at the first meeting, and that came about really because I'd moved to London, because I felt that was the only way I could really live the life I wanted to lead. And it coincided with the fact that I'd fallen in love with somebody else who wanted to work in the film industry and came to the London Film School, so he spent quite a lot of time in London. And I'd realised by then that probably the best option for me would be to get well away from my roots and live a life of my own. And that's what I did, in fact. But that was after I'd already spent some time teaching in Lancashire. In fact, the experience of teaching made me realise that I wasn't going to shed the sense that I was, if I was going to find anybody to share my life with, it wasn't going to be a woman, that was for sure. And I met people whom I became fond of, and in fact had several casual relationships with people at the time. But the person I mentioned just now, with whom I wanted to set up home in London, I met quite by accident, as it were. And he was 11 years younger than me, the same age now, I think, as my younger sister. And I think now that age difference I would have considered to be fairly important. At the time, it was one of those magical moments when you I wouldn't say throw caution to the wind, but you realise that became a major factor in my thinking about my future and so on and so forth. So eventually we set up home in London. That didn't last, and it was the time of a major AIDS epidemic, and when I recall the course of events that followed, it was a very worrying time. Although I was teaching in London, and that was my major preoccupation, I was also very nervous about making any contact with anybody because of the possibility of infection. And so I didn't, except on one or two very rare occasions. After I'd been teaching for a time, I realised I needed more qualifications, and I did a course of an advanced course in the Institute of Education in London, and therefore I'd been already I'd already experienced something of London life, although I was preoccupied and spent most of my time with the course I was doing. It's a 1-year course, and therefore that was the major issue. But I did get around in London, met people, and went to different churches. I should have said, by the way, that when I was at university I became an Anglican, but still maintain to this present day a very independent point of view about things, and can be highly critical of the institutional churches way of carrying on in all sorts of ways, liturgically, biblically, and in personal relations too. So I had a taste of London life. I went back to my job, I met this friend Jeff, and after a year I decided I needed to make a move. So that was where I stood. When I came to live in London, I was already thinking along the lines of I wouldn't say being militant, but of being freer to express my point of view in church circles. And having found LGCM, I felt that was the thing I should be concerned about. Finding a church where I felt at home was not easy. There weren't any. Every church at that time was pretty careful about expressing a radical view of this. But I did meet people from time to time, including clergy who were quite clearly gay and were prepared to risk their reputations by pursuing a gay relationship. So that gave me a sort of certain confidence. But the irony of this, of course, is that subsequently I never in fact made the sort of relationship, found the sort of friendship which would have led to what you might call a permanent partnership. But I still felt that the church had needed to get its act together about this. LGCM seemed important to me, and being in touch with people who were similarly minded was important. And so through that I met Richard Kirkland and became friends with him. Other people I particularly remember were Malcolm Johnson, who was the rector of St. Lotolds, and one or two other clergy who were quite clearly gay. As an organist, I got around quite a number of churches and met clergy who were fairly openly gay amongst people they felt were sympathetic. And so it seemed as if the church was on the move, at least, even though there were still issues. I think one thing that I was determined about, and perhaps this was a bit naive on my part, was to make this an issue that could be discussed in educational circles. And since I was teaching religious education, it seemed to me that that was a possible line of debate, inquiry, and so on. When it came to the freer expression of opinions amongst pupils at school, and things were changing, there was something at the time called Gay Liberation Front, which was, I thought, a bit scary because these people seemed to be rather ostentatious, and it wasn't my style. They weren't particularly religious, and they seemed to be more interested in, you know, it wasn't a question of whether you had sex, it was the issue was, you know, how often and how much you could get involved in that side of life. But it didn't appeal to me. I thought I was a bit more mature than that. I think I was just a bit scared, really. But I did invite them, some of them, to come along to school and talk to to some of the pupils, who used to have a sort of free debate once a week. And one of the tasks I inherited from a predecessor was to arrange for speakers to come and talk on topics of general interest, politics, and so on, and major issues. And that was one of them. It was also a bit of an eye-opener to me to realise that although I mixed with people who were free and easy about things, there were a lot of people around who were very tight-lipped and tight, might say tight-arsed about it, you know. And when one of the, there were several people came along to speak from GLA, two of them were seen by a senior member of staff walking out of the school premises holding hands. And this was reported to the head teacher, and he banned them from coming ever again, which made him look rather foolish, because the pupils who hadn't heard the speakers were furious and contacted the local paper, the Hornsey Journal, and it became a sort of public issue. So I'm sure that the head felt that he was doing the right thing. But it then became an issue in the public view. And it was around the same time that Haringey was getting in the neck from Maggie Thatcher. They'd been accused by the Sun of promoting homosexuality. They weren't doing anything of the sort. The book whose title always escapes me. It's a children's book about a gay couple who adopted a child. It was available through the teachers' centre, but they implied that it was being forced down the throats of pupils in Haringey. Haringey didn't have a particular campaign about it, but it was one of the equality issues that they did recognise, at least.
Mm.
So that was far from frightening me off. I'd always been a bit cautious about the issue in school, but perhaps I was a bit bolder than I would have been in Lancashire. This was London. It was recognised as part of human nature, and so on. So it didn't deter me at all, although we didn't ever have a public issue. We didn't have a debate about it in school after that.
So tell me then, did that run, was this sort of at the same time as you mentioned LGCM and getting involved with LGCM?
Yes.
And you doing this in schools, was this all sort of a similar time? And then
it
did
was.
3F come naturally
it was.
From that? Or?
I wasn't very churchy at the time. I was a bit fed up with the church and didn't feel very, and not just on this issue, I wasn't sure what I really thought about God and the church, you know, and I think I was much more willing to consider other ways of being. But I'd always maintained an interest in church, and I suppose one of the things that kept me going was church music. And people always assume that my main interest in church was through music. It wasn't, but it did help. Mm-hmm. Because worship had always appealed to me, I'd always enjoyed being in church, as it were. And in the times when I got rather fed up with the church's official attitude on sexuality, I could always remind myself that quite a lot of church musicians were in fact gay. Mm. And that helped me to, I suppose, help me over quite a lot of difficult situations where I think the human contact with individuals whom I got to know helped a lot.
Mm.
And some of them were clergy, some of them were church.
And that's
clergy.
How you sort of stayed, or you got back involved with
yes.
church.
Yes. And of course LGCM too, that came along, and I became a keen soldier for the cause, but at least I felt that having an opinion about it was a worthwhile thing.
Mm.
To do, and it was worth being prepared to take risks for the sake of what I consider to be truth.
So could you tell me a bit about 3F over the last few years and the group and what you've all been doing? And
well, I first went along to the meetings that were held at the Grosvenor Chapel out of curiosity. I didn't always find gay Christians particularly appealing. For various reasons, some because I thought they were had a rather toffee nose and a sort of academic approach to the whole thing. I felt a bit out of my depth because I didn't have any formal theological training, although I'd been interested in the Bible, I'd done a course at the university and so on and so forth. And at the same time, they didn't seem as attractive as some of the people who claim not to be religious, not Christian. But at the same time, I wasn't very keen on mixing in the sort of gay venues that some people thought were the major aspect of being gay. And when my partner left me, which is quite soon after I'd arrived in London, he mixed with a number of people, some of whom I got to know. But he caught the virus, and so did a number of other people that I knew. In fact, 4 ex-partners died of AIDS-related conditions, including Jack. Mm. And other people that I knew. And so I think that was a major setback for me. It was the fear of possibly catching the virus that made me think that perhaps the gay life wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and perhaps you, the best bet was to play safe. I was very nervous about my own, the possibility of my own attraction, or people being attracted to me. I didn't feel I was particularly attractive. I wasn't a sort of flamboyant, out gay in that sense at all, ever. And so I was fairly careful about it. But at the same time, I was very determined to continue my association with particularly LGCM.
Mm.
And therefore, the 3F was the natural way in which I maintained my interest. And I gradually got to know people better and better at Grosvenor Chapel. And when they finally decided to move from there, it was a rather grim setting, actually, in a sort of basement. It was cold and miserable, I thought. And I'd made contact with St. Botolph's Aldgate by then, and in fact I was appointed the organist mainly through the encouragement of Richard Kirker. I said, oh, they want a proper organist, they don't want me. But I went along and I interviewed with the staff there. And they said, well, perhaps we ought to hear you play. Would you like to play us a hymn? And I did do. And they said, oh, you'll do. And so I was appointed. So, I mean, I already knew of St. Botolph's reputation through Malcolm Johnson. And I learned very quickly that Brian Lee was the rector there, and he was a sympathetic person. Therefore, I suppose my interest in the church, my commitment, was reinforced by that experience, and the generally the liberal Catholic background, which I felt sympathetic towards, sort of came to the fore there, and people like Kenneth Leach, who was a great theologian, a left-wing theologian, and very tolerant and understanding, appealed to me too on quite other grounds, not just because of his attitude towards sexuality. He was not gay himself, but he took a very liberal view about it, and therefore his political views appealed to me as well. And I suppose although I was always a bit nervous of revolutionaries, at the same time I felt that I could never see myself voting Conservative. And therefore I felt inclined towards radical politics at the time. Although I didn't become a member of the Labour Party at the time until some time later. That lasted for some time, but New Labour didn't appeal to me, and the Iraq War finished me.
Mm. Thank you. Is there anything else in those periods of your life that you think I should have asked you about or that you'd like to share?
I think what I've reflected upon in it enabled being in contact with other people who are like-minded enabled me to think in greater depth about my own background, my roots, not just about the sort of public aspects of it, which were to do with the law and so on and so forth, but the general attitude in society. And I think I've said before that sexuality was not something that was publicly discussed. It wasn't mentioned. And in some ways, it was easier to be gay in those days because people weren't suspicious. Subsequently, I felt the need for a more overt approach, a more radical view. And this, of course, has now come to the fore. The law has been changed. There are new issues. to do with adoption and things like that. In fact, some friends at church who were a gay couple adopted children. So it's a very different story now. It's a very different world we're living in. And in some ways, it's a very much happier world. At the same time, I still think there's a long way to go, and I'm still very frustrated by the church's attitude, the overcautious attitude on the part of some people. And when the recent Archbishop's conference, whatever they called it, on this issue was held, I was disappointed with the outcome. I felt that people should have been more prepared to condemn the what I consider the unchristian attitudes that were expressed by some of the bishops, particularly the African bishop, Archbishop of Uganda, and others, and the rather careful approach to the whole issue, which seemed more concerned with maintaining a sort of Anglican appearance of unity rather than speaking the truth. That's my nonconformist background coming to the fore again.
Well, that segues really nicely into how perhaps it might be best to finish this time together in thinking perhaps about your hopes for the future regarding LGBT acceptance, particularly in the church, but also in society. What are you hopeful for, having seen so much change over the last 40 years that LGBT has been around, but longer as well? What are your hopes for the future?
Well, the issue of equality is important in a theoretical way. I've never really got too hot under the collar about the possibility of gay marriage as such, because I was never quite sure about marriage as an institution. It didn't seem to me there's anything particularly Christian about it. And to make it a major sort of plank of Christian belief, as some fundamentalists do, didn't seem to me a mistake. And they needed to read their Bibles, I thought. But my hopes are that people who consider themselves to be evangelical Christians will come to rely more on the words of Jesus and less on the legalistic aspects of the biblical tradition, especially in view of the way in which the New Testament has quite a lot to say on this subject. So I wish people would read their Bibles more, particularly the people who knock on my door and tell me that the Bible is the Word of God. And I say, well, how do you know it's the Word of God? And they said, because it says so. And I find this rather naive and frustrating. My background is liberal Protestantism, and I'm very grateful to that for that. And I still love the Anglican tradition. I made friends with Roman Catholics, and now I'm getting even more daring and making friends with Muslims, and I have known Jewish friends for a long time anyway, and coming to realise that while I don't reject the claims that Christianity is, you might say the best bet. I realise that for other people, they've been brought up in other traditions which they value, and I would never want to condemn them on the grounds of some sort of biblical quote that they seem to reject. So I don't know what that means for my hopes for the church, because I realise that once you reject any claims to uniqueness on the part of any particular tradition, you are not appealing to people who are looking for certainty. And I don't know what that means in the long term. So I would still say I'm a believing Christian. I believe in God. But I'm not very keen to try and persuade other people that they're wrong or right or whatever the case may be. When people say, well, are you a Christian? I'm a bit wary of saying yes, because I can, I'm well aware now that that can mean a variety of different things. And not all the people who claim to be Christian seem to be very Christian. Mm.
Well, thank you very much for your time. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
Well, I'd like to say thank you to you. I find it encouraging that there is still a strong Christian presence in the gay movement, even though things have changed quite a lot. And the role of, for instance, 3F, which you've mentioned, seems maybe to be changing. Most of the people who come to the meetings are well on in years, as indeed I am, as I realise now. But I still value the input that is made into Christian thinking by people who've been, have gone through this whole the process that we've been talking about today. And yes, I hope that there will still continue to be religious movements in the church which identify themselves as gay and Christian. Mm.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, John.
Thank you.
It's been really great to hear your story.